Monster Man, Episode 424, Jackalware to Kirin. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. And we're taking a look at a couple of monsters that have been updated from 1st Edition. We go through kind of a stretch of these right now. It's not going to be that way forever, but we've had a good run here of monsters that previously appeared either in Monster Manual, in Fiend Folio, or in Monster Manual 2. And I do think it's interesting to see the ways in which they have changed, or more commonly not changed very much. One of the things that is most notable about the way that monsters are approached in the 2nd edition material is the focus on ecology and habitat and even reproduction. This makes more sense if we think of this book as an encyclopedia about a fantasy world, and less sense if it's, you know, a supplement for a role-playing game, because a lot of, there are ways that you can make that stuff relevant and interesting, but it's not very game-forward, if that makes sense. And that notably, I think, applies to our next monster, the Jackalware. Now remember, a Jackalware is not a were-jackal. It's not a person who can transform into a jackal. It is a jackal who can transform into a person, or a jackal-like creature capable of temporarily assuming a humanoid form. And their motivation is just thirst for blood. This is one of those things where the Jackalware has a very fairy tale-like motivation, and it, like most things in a fairy tale, it doesn't work if you apply logic to it, but the mistake is yours for applying logic. So, for instance, Jackalwares rob their victims. For what? They're jackals. Like, they don't have bank accounts, they don't go to the shop, they eat people. Insofar as they have, like, clothes and things, I assume they take them off the bodies of their victims. That would make sense. But the idea that they care about, like, amassing gold pieces, they live in the desert with a pack of jackals. But we are meant here to understand jackals as greedy scavengers, and to look at the ways in which that idea of greedy scavenger can be applied both to humans and to jackals. Isn't man the real jackal? That kind of thing. So I don't know that all of this stuff about their ecology and, like, their life cycle is really all that necessary, because what we're dealing with here is clearly some kind of evil spirit. And they're kind of a one-note monster, right? They're one of the many ways in which Dungeons & Dragons trains you as a player character not to help people in need, because they're a monster that will appear in the form of, like, someone who needs your help. I assume that no player character is dumb enough to fall for, you know, an enchanting young whatever kind of person they're attracted to turning up and, like, singing a beguiling song or whatever. But player characters might be distracted from their path by going to help someone who's been hurt, right? So there's somebody lying in a ditch at the side of the road. They're calling for aid. Surprise, it's a Jackalware with their pack of jackal friends. Like, that's kind of it. That's kind of the encounter. So it would be more interesting if the ecology section added to that rather than just, like, explaining it when it didn't really need to be explained. So, you know, what if Jackalwares are evil spirits who manifest into jackal form? And what if there was some way that you could break the curse and return them to being normal jackals, or separate their human and jackal halves, or become a Jackalware temporarily to, like, infiltrate them? Or, you know, anything like that, right? That these are magical creatures that could give you magical possibilities, but instead, this just amounts to a detailed explanation for why they aren't more interesting than they are, instead of an attempt to make them more interesting. And they make more sense as evil spirits. A species of shape-shifting serial killers is a real weird concept, but evil spirits that can take the form of a human, but then their true jackal form is revealed, that's much more, I don't know, Arabian Nightsy. Anyway, I have spoken before about how I'm not a fan of the kind of naturalism of the way 2nd edition approaches monsters, and this is one of those things. I feel like, okay, digression. In the 90s, and indeed in the late 80s, there was a push to make, like, NPCs and things in games more, for want of a better word, psychologically realistic. But a lot of the time, this just amounted to backstory that was very hard for player characters to access. If you look at the sort of NPCs in various like Vampire the Masquerade books, they have very detailed backstories, which are supposed to like lead to understanding their motivations. But a lot of the time, those backstories are not things that the PCs will ever really understand. It's meant to be that, you know, the GM or storyteller, as they're called in Vampire, will read all this stuff, and that'll give them some insight into how to play the NPC. And I'm not saying that's useless, but the fact that so much of it was inaccessible to player characters, because, like, why would they tell you their dark secrets, you know, in this world of conspiracies where everybody's a potential enemy? What that meant was that people reading this, I think, began to get the sense that this was what the game was about, that it was the manipulations and rivalries or whatever of the elders, the ancient vampires. That was the point of the game. Otherwise, why were so many pages being spent on it? And gradually that came to be the case. Anyway, my point is simply, sometimes that backstory, especially in games like D&D, sometimes this was like anticipating player criticisms and trying to wall them off. A bunch of detailed backstory that explains why this guy will not leave until you get him the blue jewel, and you can't reason with him, you can't bribe him, you can't frighten him, etc., etc. Like a bunch of psychological folderol intended to justify a narrative contrivance. And I think, hopefully, you know, what we see in the kind of modern fantasy gaming landscape is a player base that's more open to like a diversity of genres and a diversity of play approaches, which can both be okay with that kind of narrative contrivance, but also hopefully GMs are more okay with encouraging and fostering the creativity of the players. All right, anyway, this is that. I said digression and I meant it. All right. Next up, the Kenku. This is basically just an expanded version of the Kenku section from Fiend Folio. Even the illustration is clearly inspired by the illustration in the Fiend Folio, which is usually a bad call, and this one is no exception. I said it about the Intellect Devourer, and I'll say it again. Do this illustration, but bigger, in color, and not as good. And that's no slam on the illustrator here. If you go through this book, and you look at which illustrations I don't like, you will frequently see that they're by the same, you know, one or two artists, but I feel like they got the worst jobs and they didn't, like, attempt to subvert them. So someone told you to imitate a Russ Nicholson drawing. Like, it's not your fault that you're not as good an artist as Russ Nicholson. Most people aren't. There's no shade. It's a little bit like digression number two. Can you tell this is an early morning recording session and I've just had my coffee? Digression number two. I love the Grant Morrison Howard Porter run on JLA. I think it's an all-time classic. It defines, in my mind, what Justice League comics are supposed to be like. But that one, not issue, it was three issues, that one run of JLA Confidential, where Batman fights Gorilla Grodd, that one, kind of does spoil my enjoyment of the Morrison-Porter JLA just a tiny bit. Not, I still love it, but I cannot read it without thinking, and absolutely no shade on Howard Porter. Howard Porter's a fine artist, and those issues are great, but having had those issues of JLA Confidential, you have to think to yourself, wow, how good would this run look if Ed McGuinness drew it? And kind of the same thing here, right? All this illustration does is remind you of another better illustration, and there's no shade on Howard Porter, especially Howard Porter of the 90s, to say that he was not as good an artist as Ed McGuinness, and there's no shade on whoever drew this image to say they're not as good an artist as Russ Nicholson. They're both still good. I mean, personal preference, et cetera, but I think I'm in line with the critical consensus on the Nicholson thing here. You may prefer Howard Porter to Ed McGuinness if you like, and I won't say you're wrong. Okay, so I know I just railed against ecology sections that were merely boring explanations of, like, a creature's reproductive cycle, but here's one that tries to get creative, and you know what? Maybe let's go back to the boring explanations, because this one talks about how you can sell Kenku eggs, and you can even sell infant Kenku. Like, that is slavery? And then it actually says this is slavery with all its attendant complications, and it talks about how, you know, if Kenku find out you've been, like, enslaving Kenku, they will try to free them. Good. And they will try to kidnap you. I'm not sure that that's kidnapping. I think that's arresting. I think they'll try to arrest you. I don't think it's kidnapping. I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm splitting hairs here, but sure. Plus, and I hate to say this, they're not even all that valuable. So you'd really be like, presuming you're playing a relatively sane, normal D&D game played by humans, to decide like, well, we're going to start enslaving infant Kenku would be wrenching the wheel to one side. And it's not like they're worth 10,000 gold pieces or anything like that. Like, they're not They're not that valuable. So you decided to get into some pocket change slaving. I think that's pretty unlikely, don't you? Maybe I shouldn't underestimate the crass avidity of gamers, but hard to see that one. Or maybe, you know, it was a different time. I do think that when we look at Monsters Manual, we are looking at a document that is kind of on the cusp of it being a different time, right? This is a transitional work. And so maybe it's trying to fend off some of that, like, you know, 12-year-olds around the lunchroom table going, har har, let's sell birds into slavery. Finally, we got the Kirin. This is our old friend, a celestial agent who wishes nothing but good for you and can create a certain amount of cloth. Like, it can create 32 cubic feet of soft goods or 18 cubic feet of wooden items. Well, I'm glad that we nailed that down, because it would be really unbalancing if it could create 19 cubic feet of wooden items. If it turns out that there is a numerological reason for this, then that's terrific. The description of how they use this to make little, like, pavilions and camps for themselves on the highest mountaintops, that's really cool. I actually like that. Because they're able to generate cloth and wood really easily, but like stone and metal not so much. Their camps are like these sort of like fancy tents surrounded by kind of like screens and full of hangings and tapestries. And that's kind of neat. I like that idea. Kind of gives you some sense of what visiting one would be like. And you can imagine it's up on the highest mountaintop, so there'll be lots of like pennants and banners, you know, fluttering and flapping in the wind. That's cool. I like that. Also, powerful hooves is a funny phrase. Most things that involve the word hooves are funny, and I don't know why. It's interesting that, clearly this is taken from the first edition entry, which says that it'll give you, like, a powerful hoof blow if you try to, like, mess with it. But, you know, in that one, it is the blow that is powerful. And in the other one, it is the hooves. Which is funny. Again, this is a case where I feel like the naturalistic language of Monsters Manual kind of gets in the way of some of the fun. So for instance, the Monster Manual says that they dwell, quote, above the clouds and behind the winds, close quotes. That's great. That's a fun and evocative piece of writing, and I don't think it really needed to be turned into specific instructions about where you can find one of these legendary mystical creatures that bring good luck on the hex map, you know? Again, that's me, my preference typically for my fantasy to be more fantastical. Nonetheless, a couple of good monsters today, although I will have to say that for the most part, their new versions did not add a great deal to them. This is kind of one of the problems of Monsters Manual. Sometimes you've been given the mandate to expand and update the thing, but the thing is fine. You gotta do it anyway, because you gotta do all of them. You can't just not do some of them, right? Anyway, in our next episode, we are going to be taking a look at yet more monsters from Monsters Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.